Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joshua Horowitz, Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who talks about the momentum that's building in the wake of the slaughter of 20 children and 6 teachers in Newtown, Connecticut, to reform the nation's gun control laws. Award-winning filmmaker, author, and activist Michael Moore, who reflects on the Newtown massacre and America's culture of violence. And Eric LeCompte, Executive Director of the Jubilee USA Network, who explains why he believes closing offshore tax loopholes for U.S. corporations should play a key role in the fiscal cliff budget negotiations. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is a ruler who stays out of the spotlight. In power since 1989, he succeeded his mentor Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which overthrew U.S. ally Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. In 1974, Khomeini was placed in solitary confinement at a Tehran prison, facing torture from the Shah's Savak secret police. Savak, trained by the CIA, were determined to break the opposition, but only ended up motivating activists, both religious and secular, to overthrow the hated regime. Former Iranian diplomat Syed Hossein Mousavian says American support for the Shah and his secret police shaped Khamenei's view of international politics. In the early days of the Obama administration, the new American president offered a fresh beginning with Iran. Khamenei quickly rejected the overtures, citing a long list of grievances against the United States. Since then, the U.S. and Israel, concerned about what they charge is Iran's drive to develop a nuclear weapons program, have engaged in a covert war against the Islamic Republic, involving the launch of damaging computer viruses, crippling economic sanctions, and the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. When an estimated 3 million Iranians protested in the streets against alleged election fraud in 2009, the pro-democracy Green Movement, as it was known, was quickly repressed by security police. Instead of searching for compromise, the Supreme Leader accused the protesters of treason, espionage, and working for Zionists and Americans. Burmese Buddhist monks have returned to street protests, this time to stop the expansion of a Chinese-owned copper mine and hundreds of forced evictions of local villagers. During a violent crackdown in late November, over 20 monks were burned by an incendiary device used by security forces. Some of the same monks who led the 2007 Saffron Revolution against Myanmar's military junta are now mobilizing street protests in Myanmar's largest cities, such as Yangon and Mandalay. Activists are calling for the arrest of those responsible for the violence at the Moniwa copper mine. Despite the controversy, Chinese officials say they are following the contract they signed in 2010 to invest $1 billion in the mine and pay $5 million in compensation to evicted villagers. Human Rights Watch says the confrontation at the mine is a key test for democracy under Burmese President Thein Sein. Under pressure from Western nations, which recently moved toward normalizing relations with Myanmar, the government recently appointed a commission led by opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi to investigate the planned mine expansion and its impact on villagers and the environment. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has given energy and mining companies the right to pollute numerous underground water aquifers, mostly in dry western states suffering from drought. ProPublica reports the EPA has kept poor records on the number of aquifer exemptions to safe drinking water standards that allow energy and mining companies to inject toxic chemicals deep underground. In the Rocky Mountain region, over 100 drinking water aquifers are now off limits after drillers and miners use the aquifers as a dumping ground. Natural gas extraction and mineral mining companies use the aquifers to dispose of their drilling and natural gas hydraulic fracturing or fracking waste. Advances in geological science research has raised concerns that the injection of toxic chemicals in remote underground locations could eventually migrate and pollute existing drinking water supplies. In Parched, Texas, communities desperate to find new water resources are planning on treating brackish aquifers to produce drinking water. Cities like San Antonio and El Paso are investigating the building of desalination plants at a cost of $100 million each. In the 1980s, the EPA only granted exemptions in areas where aquifers were too remote, too dirty, or too deep to supply drinking water. However, over time, the issuance of exemptions has grown due to pressure exerted by energy and mining interests. Due to growing questions about this practice, the EPA has recently established an internal review panel to examine the agency's current exemption policies. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Shock and horror were some of the emotions felt by millions when the nation and the world learned about the unspeakable slaughter of 20 innocent children and 6 teachers at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The facts as we know them are that on Friday, December 14th, 20-year-old Newtown resident Adam Lanza killed his mother with a gun she owned and then drove to the school, where he used a military-style Bushmaster AR-15 semi-automatic rifle to murder the 6 and 7-year-olds and teachers in their classroom before killing himself. The epidemic of gun violence is not a new phenomenon in the U.S. From America's inner cities to wealthy suburbs, the involvement of firearms in crime, murder, and suicide are an everyday occurrence across all 50 states. The U.S. has long had the highest rate of gun ownership in the world, with 89 guns for every 100 Americans. In 2011, the latest year for which data is available, there were 12,664 murders in the U.S. Of those, 8,583 were caused by firearms. While the murder rate in the U.S. fluctuates from year to year, there have been 62 mass shooting incidents in the last 30 years. In fact, 4 multiple murders involving guns have occurred just this year. While politicians have in recent years feared acting on or even debating stricter gun control laws due to the perceived political power of the National Rifle Association, many observers now believe the carnage in Newtown may be a tipping point. Your reporter spoke with Joshua Horowitz, executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Here he talks about the momentum that's building in the wake of Newtown to reform the nation's gun control laws.
Unfortunately, there's a long, sad history of these events. I mean, when I first got involved, a fellow named Patrick Purdy with an AK-47, shot up a schoolyard and didn't kill as many people, but killed enough and wounded a lot of people in 1989, and that was one of the precursors to the assault weapons ban. And you know, there's always been, you know, there's been from time to time these terrible shootings, but they seem to have accelerated after the expiration of the assault weapons ban at the end of 2004. I still remember, you know, sitting around and watching the first news report of Virginia Tech in utter disbelief. But of course, we've had, you know, a number of events similar to that just this year. And so, starting really with Virginia Tech, I think you saw sort of the convergence of two things. We've seen people who should not have access to firearms carrying ever more and more dangerous firearms and high-capacity magazines. And, you know, since Virginia Tech, we've had a number of other shootings. And then, of course, we had Tucson last year, and then this year, you know, with Aurora and Oak Creek. Just last week, we had the shooting in the mall in Portland, and then, of course, Friday, this you know, terrible exclamation point on a really difficult year.
President Obama's speech in Newtown at the high school there to the families and the residents of that stricken town called for an as-yet unspecified action to rein in gun violence in our nation. If you were to advise President Obama on what he could do after so many years of inaction since the 2004 weapons ban expired, what would you advise him to do?
Well, interesting that you ask. I had actually a piece on this in the American Prospect on their webpage, and I called for a number of actions. One, I said we need to make sure that we have background checks on all gun sales. Right now, that is not the case across the board. In many states, it's very easy and common to buy guns without a background check. Where I live in Virginia, you know, we have gun shows every weekend where people are selling without background checks, and of course through the classified ads and over the internet. And that's because private sellers are excluded under federal law from the background checks system, which doesn't make a lot of sense. The other thing that I would say is that we need to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. There is just no reason for the implements of war to be on our streets, and we obviously in Newtown saw the disastrous results of what type of carnage these weapons can do and how quickly and how powerful they are. And so I think we need to not only reinstate the assault weapons ban, but we need to make it stronger. Connecticut has an assault weapons ban right now. Unfortunately, it's not particularly strong, and I don't know all. We don't know all the details yet, but I assume that this weapon was what they call state compliant, meaning they took advantage of Connecticut's weak assault weapons ban to sneak this weapon in. And so we need to have an assault weapons ban similar to California that is strong. And then the last thing I would suggest that we do is take a good hard look at the way we deal with people with dangerous mental illness. I think the system that we have right now is, I guess we would call it both under and over inclusive, where you bring a lot of people into the system, some of them who may be dangerous, and leave people outside the system who are very dangerous. And because the reason is what we should be looking at in this country is people who are a danger to itself and others, and that's really not the standard we have. And there's some very nice Connecticut actually has some of these laws, but they're complicated. California actually has a much easier model where a treating psychiatrist or mental health professional can easily and temporarily remove arms from somebody who they believe to be dangerous and let that person be evaluated. And that's really the types of things that you want to have happen. You want to create extra tools for the psychiatric community. So those are the three things where I would start. I can tell you about lots of other things I would do as well. But that's, I think, if someone said, what are the top three, that's what they are: background checks, assault weapons ban, and thinking really hard and redoing the way we deal with the intersection of mental health and firearms.
Well, thank you, Joshua. Just a last quick word here. Are you optimistic that change will happen this time?
Yeah, yes, I am. I've been very, because of the events of this year, I've been optimistic even before Friday about the ability to change laws and this terrible, and you know, we are determined that this terrible tragedy will not be forgotten. And so, you know, as sad as we are, and I have survivors on my staff, somebody who works for me whose daughter was shot and thankfully survived the Virginia Tech shooting, you know, we also know that we need to use the big spotlight that comes when these events happen to organize, to collect our side and to go on to victory. And that's going to be a long, hard road, but I think the path is now clear.
That was Joshua Horowitz, Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Learn more about the group's campaign to pass new, stricter gun control laws by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On the evening of Friday, December 14th, folk singing legend Pete Seeger and singer-actor Harry Belafonte hosted a concert at New York City's Beacon Theater titled Bring Leonard Peltier Home in 2012. Peltier, a Native American activist and a member of the American Indian Movement, was arrested after two FBI agents, Jack Kohler and Ronald Williams, were killed in a 1975 shootout on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. Despite a case that Peltier's supporters maintain was riddled with lies and corruption, the activist was convicted of aiding and abetting in the murders of the FBI agents and sentenced to two consecutive life terms. Leonard Peltier has been in prison for 37 years, and because he's now in failing health, his friends fear he may soon die there. The benefit concert, which included music, poetry, and discussion of his case, was organized to urge President Obama to free the ailing American Indian prisoner before Christmas. Among those appearing at the event were musicians Bruce Coburn and Jackson Brown, and actors Danny Glover and Peter Coyote. The concert took place just hours after the massacre of 20 children and 6 teachers at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. That prompted many of the performers to talk about the carnage including filmmaker Michael Moore, who won an Academy Award for his documentary Bowling for Columbine about the 1999 mass shooting at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the concert and recorded Moore's remarks about the Newtown, Connecticut massacre and America's culture of violence, which are presented here.
Earlier today, a crazy man went to an elementary school and attacked 22 children in China. A few hours before Connecticut, an elementary school was attacked in China by an insane man, and 22 children were his victims. But all he had was a knife. Total number of dead in the Chinese elementary school? Zero. I hope you don't mind, but I'd like to just say a few words about what happened today, because I've been concerned about this issue for a long time. Yes, we need more gun control. Yes, we need free mental health services in this country. But I really believe that even if we had better gun control laws and better mental health, that we would still be the sort of sick and twisted, violent people that we've been for hundreds of years. That is something that's just in our craw, just in our DNA. And to get that out of our DNA is going to take a lot more than passing a bill in Albany or D.C. That's not going to do it. And you know, other countries, I mean, they have their crazy people, and they have people, they've been shootings and killings in Norway and France and in Germany. But there haven't been 61 mass killings like there have been in this country just since Columbine. 61 mass shootings in this country. I like to say that I sort of agree with the NRA when they say guns don't kill people, people kill people, except I would just modify that a bit to say guns don't kill people, Americans kill people. Because that's what we do. We invade countries, we send drones in to kill civilians. We've got 5 wars going on right now where our soldiers are killing people. I mean, 5 that we know of. We are on the short list of illustrious countries who have the death penalty. We believe it's okay to kill you when you've committed a crime. And then we have all the other forms of violence in this country that we don't really call violence, but they are acts of violence. When you make sure that 50 million people don't have health insurance in your country, and that according to the congressional study that was done, 44,000 people a year die in America for the simple reason that they don't have health insurance, that's a form of murder. That murder is being committed by the insurance companies. When you evict millions of people from their homes, that's an act of violence. That's called a home invasion. All the wrong people are in prison in this country. I can't believe we're just standing blocks away from the biggest criminal operation that this country has ever seen, right down that street. And not one of them has gone to prison for what they've done. When you've eliminated so many millions of jobs, when you've ruined communities like mine in Flint, Michigan, you have killed people. Because having seen firsthand the effects of these corporate decisions, the alcoholism, the drug abuse, divorce, suicide, all the social problems that go along with this act of violence, but we don't call it violence, and no one's ever arrested for it. I think it's a real shame. And frankly, as an American, this is not how I want to be remembered.
That was filmmaker, author, and activist Michael Moore, whose documentary film Bowling for Columbine won an Academy Award in 2002. Special thanks to Lorna Tucker for additional audio recording for this segment. For more commentary and analysis about gun violence in America, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With less than 2 weeks before the deadline for concluding the fiscal cliff negotiations, President Obama and Republican Speaker of the House John Boehner have reportedly moved closer to an agreement on both generating new revenue and budget cuts. Without a deal between the White House and Congress before January 1st, all Americans will see an automatic tax increase of $500 billion and $109 billion in domestic program and Pentagon spending cuts. News reports indicate that President Obama has told the GOP House leader that he's willing to adjust his original demand for an increase in tax rates on those making more than $250,000 downward to those with an annual income of more than $400,000. All rates on other tax brackets would remain unchanged. But one of the most contentious issues in the negotiations angering progressive activists are reports that Mr. Obama has offered to change the way cost of living adjustments are made to Social Security benefits. According to economists, moving to a so-called chain consumer price index will reduce benefits for the average 65-year-old by about $6,000 in the first 15 years of retirement and $16,000 over 25 years. But the group Jubilee USA Network believes that if U.S. corporations paid $150 billion in taxes that they now avoid every year through exploiting offshore tax loopholes, it would reduce the pressure to cut programs benefiting working families and more than cover the $109 billion in automatic spending cuts. Your reporter spoke with Eric LeCompte, executive director of the Jubilee USA Network, who explains why he believes that closing offshore tax loopholes, both for corporations and the nation's wealthiest citizens, should play a key role in the current fiscal cliff budget negotiations.
The reality is that if corporations and very wealthy individuals paid their taxes instead of using these offshore tax loopholes, these tax havens that we heard a lot about during the presidential election, if these corporations didn't use these tax havens, these wealthy individuals, they didn't avoid their taxes, they would essentially be contributing $150 billion a year additionally to the United States, which right there, you know, that totally wipes out the fiscal cliff. So, you know, for many of us, you know, who've been looking at this issue, it seems that a very easy way to be able to deal with this fiscal cliff discussion is just closing the offshore tax loopholes. We've heard a lot about, you know, increasing taxes on the 2%. But the reality of it is just by looking at these tax loopholes, it would solve our problem. And it's so significant that just over the next 10 years, you know, this lost revenue would achieve 40%, almost 40% of the $4 trillion debt reduction goal that the bipartisan leaders in Congress have put forward. So it's a big piece on the table. You know, we're happy the White House has finally responded and said we're looking at this seriously and certainly are going to look to solve it, you know, over the next few years. But it's something that, you know, needs to be a part of the solution right now.
Tell us about some of the nation's largest corporations that engage in these offshore tax shelters that prevent the federal government from getting revenue that they otherwise would obtain to add to the federal budget, and some of the wealthy individuals that also take advantage of these loopholes.
Well, certainly. I mean, it's absolutely remarkable. 60% of these taxes come from corporations, $90 billion, and these are household names. It's everything from Google to Apple to Walmart. At least 83 of the top 100 publicly traded corporations in the United States make use of these tax havens. So that additionally includes Coca-Cola, Pfizer, Microsoft, ExxonMobil, Bank of America, and of course the list goes on and on. So they use these tax avoidance schemes. They don't pay their share of the taxes, and that's why we even see companies like General Electric, GE, when they're making record profits, actually getting tax rebates from the U.S. government because they're using these offshore tax loopholes. So essentially, these very wealthy, these large corporations are keeping more than 70% of their cash offshore. And by doing that, they're continuing to use these offshore loopholes. And not only does it include, you know, the top 83 of the 100, it is 30 of America's largest, most profitable corporations. They actually make money off the tax code, like General Electric and others.
What has been the response from members of Congress and the Obama administration about the specific points you've raised about the role closing these tax loopholes could play in resolving a large part of the U.S. debt situation?
Well, you know, in terms of the White House, they certainly have taken the issue seriously. And over the last week, they've been putting out press statements that we need to put the corporate tax code on the table. And so that's very positive to know that essentially, you know, that's already a part of the conversation. We've been heartened to hear at Jubilee USA from several members of Congress who have said, thank you, you know, for mobilizing the faith community. Thanks for putting the word out, because now members of Congress are looking at this more seriously. So let me give you an example of how this has been taken on over the last year. Senator Carl Levin from Michigan had introduced legislation earlier in this Congress called the Stop Tax Haven Abuse Amendment. And this legislation is very important because, number one, what this legislation does, it essentially moves more corporations to make use of the Fair Tax Code and not to utilize tax havens. So, you know, we're very serious, you know, not only because, you know, the White House is starting to raise more of an interest or members of Congress, but we're very serious about moving this forward over the next year. And I think the other reason that we believe it's so important, as I noted, is that this is also global behavior. So, you know, there are corporations that essentially are doing business throughout Africa, Latin America, and Asia, and they're not paying taxes in those countries either. They're moving their profits out through the same kind of offshore tax loopholes, moving them into tax havens where they're not paying money in countries that essentially need basic infrastructure and are looking for access for food. So by closing these offshore loopholes here in the U.S., by sending a message around the fiscal cliff here, we're also sending a global message to corporations that, you know, this kind of sketchy, dodgy corporate behavior won't be tolerated globally.
That was Eric LeCompte, Executive Director of the Jubilee USA Network. Find links to more information about Jubilee's proposals to close offshore tax loopholes on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.